This is the 2 North Jackson Podcast with news, insights, details, and accomplishments from Alabama's 67 county governments. Welcome to the 2 North Jackson Podcast for September of 2022. This month, we'll talk about unintended consequences, the ability to recruit poll workers, and debris on county roads. We'll start with our friend Jay Jones, Lee County Sheriff, and talk about some unintended consequences from the passage of Act 2022-133. And Jay, we appreciate you joining us today.
I appreciate the invitation. Thank you, Sonny. It's always a pleasure.
And Jay is a familiar face and voice all over the state. He's been sheriff in Lee County for 24 years, but has been an employee in Lee County for almost half a century.
Coming up on 47 years, as a matter of fact. And I get strange stares from the people at RSA, but I would think I'm their favorite person as long as I'm working.
That's right. That's right. The math may be working in their favor, not yours.
That is correct.
But Jay is also serving currently as president of the Alabama Sheriff's Association, and we've worked very closely over the last decade with the sheriffs on a number of projects and issues that have affected law enforcement at the county level. And this past session, a bill introduced by Representative Shane Stringer dealt with the need for pistol permits in order to carry a gun inside a vehicle in Alabama. And today our discussion is really not the content of that new law that becomes effective January 1, but some unintended consequences from the passage of that law, and specifically the reduction in revenue at the county level from the purchasing of pistol permits. Sheriff, if you could just tell our listeners a little bit about the pistol permit process and give us an idea of the kind of revenue that is generated in Lee County.
Sure. It depends, of course, upon the county. All the sheriffs are the issuing authority, as most people know. And in Lee County, and in many counties, we have an online process that allows a person to go to our website, and they are able to walk themselves through the process of applying, and they have the option of course, using a credit card, or in our particular case, you can actually select the option to come down personally and secure the permit and just pay for it at the sheriff's office. The procedure is pretty short, and certainly one of the requirements we have by law is doing a background check on individuals that we feel is kind of important, and ensuring that we're not issuing a concealed carry permit to an individual that really should not be receiving one in the first place. It provides kind of a check in that regard, but the background check is a requirement in all 67 counties, of course.
And the new law that eliminates the requirement doesn't mean you can't continue to purchase pistol permits, but eliminates the requirement that you have that permit for a loaded handgun inside your vehicle has impacted, I assume, the flow of people who are coming to the sheriff's department to purchase or renew those permits.
That's right. We have seen a noticeable reduction in the applications and renewals on permits. It has not stopped entirely, but it has dropped since the bill was signed into law back in March of this year. And you mentioned, of course, currently the requirement stays in place till January 1 of this coming year, at which time a permit will no longer be required. Where you're going to still be issuing the permits, the permit issuing system has not gone away. And some people have become confused on that. They think that the permits are being done away with entirely. We certainly want to get the word out that no, absolutely not. We're continuing to issue permits. And there's a specific reason that I would like to focus on that. In Alabama, if you're a citizen, then your requirement to have the permit is not there to carry a loaded handgun on yourself concealed or in your vehicle. But let's say you'd like to visit some friends or relatives in another state. Here's where it becomes important. We are still recommending and encouraging people to continue to obtain a concealed carry permit, because when you travel to another state, then that might be a requirement that you need to adhere to. For instance, in the state of Florida, it is a felony offense there if you do not have a permit. And of course, Florida is one of our reciprocal states, as all states that are contiguous to Alabama are. And we just think it's insurance, if you will, when you travel to another state with a loaded handgun. And I can assure you, from a standpoint of law enforcement, the public safety officers appreciate it. Again, not a requirement, but certainly it's something that I think is important and just gives you a little bit more peace of mind in the event of a interaction with law enforcement.
And certainly the pistol permit is something that can reduce the stress level on those situations when they occur at night, on the side of a road, those kind of things. It certainly is a benefit to law enforcement, and we do want to continue to encourage everyone to get the pistol permit, if for no other reason than for that, to help our law enforcement officers do their job more effectively. But there's another side to the pistol permit process, and that is that for you and for your other colleagues, that revenue has allowed you to provide services and equipment and resources to your employees that might not otherwise be available.
That is exactly right. We use our funds that are generated from the issuance of the concealed carry permits for equipment purchased. This can include everything from the patrol vehicles to ballistic vests for our officers, our deputy sheriffs, technology that helps us in regard to solving crimes. And I would have to say that the majority of our fees generated through the permit process are used for training and education. And if there is something more important than training and education of our law enforcement officials in this day and time, then I'd like somebody to show it to me. We focus probably more than 75% of our funding toward expenses associated with training and education of our law enforcement officers. And that's something that we feel extremely strong about, and making sure that we are providing our employees, regardless of whether they work in our corrections division with our jail operations or our enforcement division answering calls for service on 911, they need to have the best tools they can have, along with, and just as important, the knowledge and information that gives them the best options that they can make decisions in the field and provide the best service to their communities.
Well, the new law does take effect January 1. As you said, the requirement as we sit here in September still exists that you must have the pistol permit, but your revenue has already declined. I guess people read about it and heard about it, didn't realize perhaps that it's not effective until January 1. The legislature attempted to make provisions for this loss in revenue, but we made it our convention with a large group of sheriffs, and it was pretty much the consensus statewide, I think, from the sheriffs that the amount of revenue and the process that was included in Representative Stringer's legislation probably is not going to provide what's needed at the local level.
We certainly agree with that. I know my colleagues around the state and the sheriffs in other counties feel the same way. Having a, I believe it's referred to as a grant source established at $5 million in the legislation, that's good, but we're all afraid it's going to fall far short of what will actually be required once these revenues start to drop, once the law takes effect at the beginning of the year. Just looking at the figures from other sheriffs and around the state, our figures for sure, you can project percentages, and the fees that were received through previous years with the issuance of a permit are not going to be what they are once this law takes effect. And certainly $5 million sounds like a lot of money, and it is. But when you're looking at all 67 counties and the loss of revenue just on early projections, it's not going to be enough.
In Lee County, and as we sit here, we've been through 8-9 months of the calendar year. Give us an idea about your numbers and what you've seen in terms of specific decline on fees.
Sure, and information I'm providing is based on the first 8 months of comparative basis from 2021 and, of course, 2022. And to date, through the 8 months of the year that have been completed so far, the sheer numbers of permits issued are down by over 2,400. As opposed to the year 2021. And what that converts to in actual terms of revenue is a negative figure of over $117,000 that we would have received in previous years, but it's down, and that equates close to a 35% decline just on the 8 months that have taken place this year. And of course, we'll know more at the end of the year, but the trend doesn't appear to be changing.
And so when the legislature reconvenes, there are a few things from Representative Stringer's bill that we hope to address. One of those is the sheer size of the revenue that's available. The bill, as introduced and as passed and signed into law, provided a pot that begins at $5 million and then is reduced down to $2 million in subsequent years. Clearly, statewide, that will not be enough revenue. But it also uses the year 2022 as the base year, which, as you've just told me, sounds like on its face is a real problem too.
And it is. I think that the numbers are definitely not going to be accurate if you take the 2022 year. I would suggest, and there are many others that feel the way I do, that we should look at 2021 as opposed to 2022, or even maybe a comparative of both 20 and 21, and let's get a real solid figure in there and then do some comparing as opposed to just picking the year of the actual passage of the legislation and trying to come up with some figures that way. I think that would give us a more realistic figure than the one that we're receiving if we keep 2022 as a base year.
And that's not us collectively, the County Commission Association and the sheriffs, being nitpicky. The outcome of that decision may mean millions of dollars in less revenue available for law enforcement in this state. And from the start, everyone involved, even the folks who were on the other side of what was a very emotional argument, even those people admitted consistently, we're not going to do anything to hurt law enforcement. And I don't think there's any question that unless we replace this revenue, we will have hurt law enforcement.
I would agree. I know the buzz phrase has always been defund the police. And I know that phrase was brought into play a few times. We'll stay away from that. But the fact of the matter is there will be a reduction in funds available to provide what sheriff's offices need around the state. And based on the location of the county and the economic circumstances, some counties will be better able to handle it. Some will not, simply because of the circumstances based on their economies, and they're really going to hurt. There's no doubt in anyone's mind, I think, that there's going to be some issues where county commissions are going to be really strapped in coming up with additional funding that's going to have to be made up unless there's some source of revenue outside of just the commission budget itself.
Well, Sheriff, we appreciate very much the opportunity to visit for a few minutes. And from a personal level, the working relationship and friendship that we've developed over the years, it's been my pleasure to work with you. And I hope you will continue to make the retirement system happy by continuing to stay where you are in Lee County.
As long as the folks would like that, I plan on doing that very thing.
Next, we'll turn our attention to a statewide issue affecting all 67 counties as we grow closer to this year's general election. Joining us today is Judge David Money, who has served as Henry County's probate judge and commission chairman since being elected to the office in 2012. And whether you believe 10 years in office to be a short or a long amount of time, I must say that Judge Money has maximized every single moment in his role as a public servant. Honestly, I'm not aware of any area of county government or any aspect of this association to which he has not freely offered his time, his knowledge, or his passion for the betterment of all 67 counties. From the association aspect alone, he's served on the ACCA Legislative Committee, the self-funded insurance boards, he's completed the plan leadership program, and as most of you likely remember, he was the association's president at the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic and really was the guiding light for the association when, as we all know, the chaos and confusion hit the entire globe. So I will say, whether he admits it or not, Judge Money really is a great resource when it comes to overcoming obstacles in county government. And as probate judge, he's fully aware of the obstacles in election administration. So, Judge Money, it really is a pleasure to have you with us today.
Good morning, Abby. You're much too kind, but it's always a pleasure to talk with you or any association staff member. Thank you for having me.
Well, as we sit here at the end of September, the general election for 2022 is now just over a month away. And those in your position across the state, as well as employees at the local level, are actively working to prepare and get everything organized in order to welcome voters on November 8th. Of course, there are a multitude of moving parts when it comes to administering our elections. And, you know, the probate judges and local employees do such a tremendous job of keeping everything on track. But today, we just want to focus a few minutes on the individuals that we will all interact with when casting our vote. The face of Election Day, if you will, our poll workers and the important role that they will play on November 8th and the obstacles counties are experiencing in recruiting poll workers. Judge, if you will, could you take a few minutes to tell us what the typical day for a poll worker looks like? What are their responsibilities on Election Day? I know polls are open from 7 in the morning to 7 in the evening. Do they change shifts for that? How does all of that work?
Well, you're exactly right, Abby. They are just invaluable to the process. Obviously, we couldn't do anything without them. To answer your question, no, we do not change shifts, but we do encourage the inspector at each site to give our poll workers an opportunity during the day to walk around, stretch their leg, get some fresh air. All poll workers are asked to be at their precinct location no later than 6:30 in the morning on Election Day. They stay there until everything has been finalized and the inspector is ready to take the returns back to the courthouse. Their roles are actually assigned to them by their precinct inspector. We do ask that they all sit together as a team on the days we have the formal training school, which this year will be on November 1st. Then when they get to election day on November 8th, it will be a 14-hour day for most of them. We found that in the past two or three election cycles, it's really become increasingly more difficult to enlist the number of poll workers that we need to properly facilitate a well-run election in Henry County. In the primary runoff, we use 67 clerks and 15 inspectors, and we'll use considerably more than that in the general.
Well, and I think you and I both agree that it takes a special calling for someone to want to be involved in public service. But of course, that also means it's not necessarily an item on everyone's bucket list. So it's not too hard to understand that we could find ourselves in a situation where we're struggling to recruit individuals to work the polls, especially when you factor in, you know, the long hours and the many responsibilities that they have. Can you talk a little bit about your experience in recruiting poll workers and the recruitment issues that counties are facing today?
Sure. And in my conversations with other probate judges, this is generally a problem throughout the state. You know, I think we can all agree that, unfortunately, the spirit of volunteerism has waned considerably in the past few years. It's probably a sign of the times, but COVID only made it worse. The 2020 election cycle was really a nightmare. We may all remember that the Secretary of State approved a one-time bonus, $50 per poll worker. That was a tremendous help to us in the recruitment of election clerks. Thankfully, as with most counties, the majority of our poll workers have been with us for years. It's really become a fraternity of sorts. It's a social event that many of them look forward to. In the past, we assigned one of our probate clerks in the clerk's office to call 80 to 100 citizens to see if they would be willing to serve on election day. But after COVID, Henry County increased the compensation for our clerks and inspectors. So my plan this year is a little bit different. I plan to get up with each of the 15 inspectors and give them a pre-assigned number of poll workers for that particular precinct and give them the responsibility of contacting those clerks that he feels most comfortable working with. Now, once that's been done, the list will be given back to us in the probate office, and we'll assign one probate clerk the responsibility of sending an information letter to each worker, showing them the date, time, and the location of the election school. They'll also be given a stamp self-addressed envelope that we ask them to sign that they've received it and that they will indeed be working, and send it back to us at the probate office in plenty of time as we get ready for the election. I think this kind of works better for the inspector, gives him a little bit more of a comfort zone, and the probate clerk a lot of relief not having to call all these people. So we're looking forward to trying that in just a couple of weeks and making sure that it's an improvement on the process that we use here in Henry County.
And we both know that once we get past the November 8th hurdle, it'll be time to start preparing for the next round of elections in 2024 and then in 2026 and so on and so forth. Do you have any thoughts in terms of a long-term strategy or solution on what we can be doing to address the shortage in poll workers statewide?
You know, it's something that we all think about every day this time of the year. And sometimes at 2 o'clock in the morning, how are we going to handle this situation? We're constantly thinking of ways that would help not necessarily us as officials in an election, but those who are really the boots on the ground people who are going to be out there meeting the public, as you said earlier. I think there are two things that really have helped us tremendously. First, one of the best moves that we've made during my 10 years in office was to engage our local churches in the Election Day process. 25 years ago or so, the county commission back then purchased about a dozen small metal buildings to be used as voting houses. They were very small, and they did not have indoor restroom facilities. So last 3 years, I began contacting local churches about the possibility of using their fellowship halls on Election Day. And when we do that, we promise them two or three things. We promise them that we're going to leave it cleaner than we find it. We promise them that we're not going to put any tape or anything on the walls that would adversely affect the paint, which sounds simple, but, you know, we sure don't want to avoid that. But the third thing is we pay them $200 each time that we use their facility. This helps with their power bill, and it's just a public relations measure, and we still come out economically better than having to use the portable buildings. As in most counties, or a lot of counties, most of our poll workers are older females. They feel safer in fellowship halls of churches than they did those portable buildings, especially during the general election when they leave their precinct 3 hours after dark, be the case on November 8th. You know, they don't have to use those danged old porta potties. You don't know the ladies that thanked me and hugged me for doing that. Several churches have increased their membership just by citizens coming to their church for the first time to vote. So we've now eliminated all of those portable buildings except two. And my plan before I get out of here in 2024 is to rectify those two as well. The second thing that I think has really helped us is our usage of student interns to sign the voters in. We use high school students primarily, and they have to be 16 or older. They cannot be involved beyond greeting them when they're outside, you know, just that friendly face saying thank you for coming to vote, and also signing voters in on the poll pads. While the law states that they cannot be paid, they can and they do count their time on election day toward community service hours. We use a lot of the students in our Henry County Youth Leadership Program to do that. We've had more than one student tell us that their involvement with the election process weighed heavily with scholarship committees. One, in fact, told me that a committee member told him the deciding factor on offering him a college scholarship was his involvement at that age in the election process. It gets them involved while they're still in high school, and hopefully as they see others come in and exercise our right to vote, this will indelibly affect what they do going forward in being a part of the election process. So just one of a few of several, but those are the two things I think that have helped us more than any other.
Well, Judge, we want to thank you again for taking a few minutes out of your day to talk with us and to shine a spotlight on the obstacles that are facing counties right now as we prepare for the coming election. And of course, I would be remiss not to share a personal thank you for all that you do behind the scenes for the association staff and truly for all 67 counties.
Well, that's very kind again. I thank you. And listen, I just think every day, if every county commissioner, every county official would utilize ACCA as we have done in Henry County, we could not possibly do the job we do without the assistance of everyone in Montgomery on the ACCA staff. So thank you very much for allowing us to do that. Thank you for all that you do for all 67 counties.
And now our final topic of discussion this month is a focus on debris management and the interaction and working relationship between Alabama's county governments and the Alabama Department of Transportation. And joining us today is George Connor, the Deputy Director of Operations for ALDOT. George, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Sonny. Delighted to be a part.
We've been working together on this issue of debris for a long, long time. I think things really changed in Alabama. The public's perception changed in 2011 when we had the horrific tornado outbreak here in April. And in an effort to try to help the citizens in what was a massively challenging recovery, reaction, response, together, ALDOT, the state, the governor's office, we said anything the storm generated, get it to the roadside, get it to the right-of-way, we'll clean it up. Now, that was an unusual storm, but that has set the tone. It's a bell we really can't unring. And the public now sees that the government's role in these kind of storms is to help them clean up and get rid of the debris that was generated by the storm, for right or for wrong. And the change in FEMA's approach so that we can be reimbursed for the debris that has been placed on the right-of-way forged this pathway for ALDOT and the counties to get an actual written agreement that lays out how this process is going to work going forward. And you tested it in Sally and Zeta. The department invested time and effort and manpower, and you did more than just your traditional single pass to get the roads clear. So if you could talk about that a little.
Your membership will be well aware that FEMA has a very specific and sometimes intricate application process and documentation process for that removal. But the first hurdle to pass is that the applicant can only be the owner of the right-of-way that the debris is being removed from, unless there is an explicit written agreement that predates the event between the DOT or the owner and a third party that would allow the third party to pick up the debris and then file directly with FEMA. both county and state, we all use contractors to pick that debris, but they're working on the behalf of the owner. A common example is in a municipality, public works groups will start picking up debris quickly and often ahead of the time when ALDOT might arrive in that particular municipality. For them to pick that up and file for reimbursement with FEMA, there has to be a pre-existing agreement saying that ALDOT gives permission and the municipality agrees to do it. Similar arrangements need to be made with any third party, and counties included, and that's been some of the work that you and I, Sonny, have done over the last many months to get to this point.
And so Sally and Zeta, the department, cleaned the right-of-way from the debris that was put there by the storm. Then, as you said, you made additional passes to remove the debris that the storm created. And eventually the department said, okay, to the public, we're finished. Now, at the same time the department's doing that on state right-of-way, the county's doing that on the county right-of-way. And so what we've worked on and what came from the department, from the director, and you interacting with us, then to our board of directors, and you were at the convention to talk about, is a process where the department's going to take care of the state right-of-ways. Counties are going to take care of county right-of-ways, but we are going to work together because there may be circumstances where the department can look at the county, especially because of our joint bid contracts, and at the department's request, the counties could assist the department on the state right-of-ways.
Correct. That statement of understanding that the department and the county commission association jointly developed and which was adopted during the last board meeting laid out three approaches to storm debris removal on state-owned right-of-ways. First approach, ALDOT does it all, and that would be the normal operation going forward. Second approach, ALDOT needs assistance and requests from a county. Would you use your contractors to pick this debris up and file directly with FEMA? We would have executed the necessary agreement that FEMA wanted. So you would get the federal reimbursement, you get the state reimbursement, and ALDOT in that scenario agrees to pay the remaining share, the applicant's match, which presently runs 12.5% of the debris removal cost. And then the third scenario is ALDOT requests the county to assist when there's not FEMA eligibility determined or it's not eligible for FEMA. And in those scenarios, if ALDOT requests and if the county agrees, the county would be working as a contractor to ALDOT, and ALDOT would pay the county agreed upon rates for the work that they were doing. So those are our three statements of position that ALDOT and ACCA have said we will follow or incorporate these in our future operations.
Today, as we speak here at the end of September, the department's legal staff and our legal staff here at the association are working together on the documents that we'll need to make this work smoothly, because we can agree to whatever we want to, but we got to make sure Big Brother in Washington, D.C., that we touch all those bases so that the federal money can flow. And those documents aren't ready yet, but they'll be coming to the counties very, very soon. And where we will be, I think, is where we've all wanted to get in the aftermath of the changes that have occurred, and that is the department can forge forward on its right-of-ways under the process it wants to follow. At the same time, the county can be marching forward, cleaning county rights-of-way under these unfortunate circumstances. And if we need each other, we've got a agreed-upon, established, formal way to help each other. And if it turns out we don't, we don't. If it turns out we do, we've done what our emergency management staff has tried to teach us to do, and that is let's plan while the sun is shining, so that if these bad events occur, we're ready. And from the association side, I want you to know that I'm extremely grateful for the working relationship we have on all issues. But on this one in particular, George, it's been our pleasure to work with you and for us to be at a place where I think we're going to be more efficient. I think that both of us are going to be more responsive to the citizens. And in the end, I think we're both going to have less headaches too.
And I'm all for that. And likewise, I would say on behalf of the department, on behalf of Director Cooper, and certainly from myself, I appreciate the things we've been able to work through. And it doesn't guarantee that there won't be issues going forward that haven't been anticipated, but the basis for addressing them is more clearly laid out and make the act of working through them easier and more straightforward.
and the problems that arise. We'll communicate and we'll work those things out. And there are going to be problems. Every person listening to this podcast knows that every disaster event's different. And so we'll figure those things out together. But for the association, we're in a much better place. And by we, I mean county government and ALDOT, certainly than we've been any time since that seed changed a few years ago. And George, we appreciate you joining us very much. And we appreciate also the hard work in getting us to where we are.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here and to address your membership. And thank y'all for the help that you give ALDOT as well.
Well, thank you all for joining us for this month's 2 North Jackson podcast. We look forward to catching up with you again during next month's episode, which will be released to the county family on Monday, October 31st, which, if I'm thinking correctly, is probably Halloween. Have a good day.